You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Hello and welcome to the show. Stu Goldsmith here. I am at the Edinburgh Festival currently. It's 2019 and this is the first of a bunch of podcasts I'm recording. I've got some real corkers in the can, besides a load of really great ones from Montreal that I will be eking out over the next few weeks and months. This is the first one of the Edinburgh ones, and it's an absolute belter. This is Vicky Stone, who you may be aware of. She's done a couple of little kind of viral video type things over the years, but she's got a great name at Edinburgh. And as you will discover, she also has fingers in many musical pies. What a horrendous phrase I immediately regret. But rarely do we have someone on the show who is such a phenomenal... Not just a phenomenal talent, but phenomenally skilled in so many different ways. I think she might be... She's not our first composer. We've had mentioned before. But I think you're really going to enjoy this. This is a really exciting... I think it's a really thrilling look at a completely different way of looking at building material. This is Vicky Stone. Welcome.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Congratulations on your show.
Thanks. Thanks for coming.
How's it going? This is very Edinburgh, this one. When I record shows at Edinburgh, I sometimes try and make them not very Edinburgh specific, so they can go out later in the year, but this is going to go out soon.
Oh, great.
So let's steep it in the Edinburgh Festival. How is it going? You've done three?
I've done three. Well, I've not done a full run at the Edinburgh Festival for now for 5 years. So my last full run...
Is that right?
Yeah, my last full run was in 2014. I've come back, but I've done that thing of doing one-offs in the Grand, which I can thoroughly recommend. You know, one-offs in a big venue, come in for one day,
wow,
sell loads of tickets and then leave. That's an amazing way of doing Edinburgh.
I have never talked about that way of doing Edinburgh with someone. Amazing. Okay.
And I did that in 2017 and it was... absolutely brilliant.
You took, how big is the Grand? Is it
the grand is 750.
Okay.
And I think I shifted just under 500 or something along those lines. And it was the most financially successful Edinburgh I've ever had. Just coming in one day,
yep,
busting out. Because I think it was one of the big acts had to leave a day early. So it was the last day of the Fringe. And I just came in with a big show.
So you've got the lead-in time of the entire Fringe.
Yeah, the entire
Fringe.
This
is happening at the end.
This is happening at the end. It was a big show that I did with an orchestra. And yeah, I bust in on one day and had a rehearsal. There was something really amusing that on that particular show, I came with a 26-piece orchestra and I just put on my rider that I needed 26 chairs. And the Pleasance went, "Do you think we've just got 26 chairs kicking around?" Of course we haven't.
We're using every single chair. Yeah, chairs are the most valuable commodity.
So they said, "You've got to hire chairs in." And I was like, "Oh, okay." And it was the most ridiculously difficult thing. I had to get chairs in from Glasgow, because there were no chairs to be hired in Edinburgh.
That's like Glastonbury not happening because the Olympics were using
all the toilets. Yeah. that is exactly it. And it was more cost effective for me to buy chairs from IKEA, but I didn't want to because then I was like, well, I couldn't square the waste of 26 chairs or the scene of me going around the streets of Edinburgh trying to give away 26 chairs.
Like a rag and bone lady, but for chairs, for venues. Oh, you could get in touch with one of the Free Fringe organisations. They would organise. Yeah, definitely.
So this year is my first full run in 5 years.
And the run you did in 2014, was that instrumental?
Yes.
Tell us about that show, because I didn't see it, but
that show was a concept show, really. It was me playing loads of instruments and a lute pedal, and it was instruments that I'd borrowed off people. So they all kind of came with the story, and I'd sort of play them for a bit and add them to the soundscape.
Okay.
So it was sort of bridging the gap between stand up and theatre.
So you were looping, so you would play a bit of a melody or something, yeah, and then loop it, and yeah, it would stay there for the whole show.
Not for the whole show, but the whole thing would gradually evolve. So then you'd stop things and they'd become other things. And it was sort of I think someone described it as like a sort of rock opera version of stand-up. So it was...
Because the other thing I know you for is doing... Now, what was it called? Was it the Symphony... For a clown.
Oh, the Concerto for Comedian and Orchestra. That's the thing that I did in the Grand. That was the thing with the 26
okay,
chairs.
Tell us about that, and then I'll start asking you questions. But just tell us about that, because this is a body of work like no other, isn't it?
It's a four movement concerto, and it's there are lots of spoken word orchestral pieces like Peter and the Wolf, and I wanted to create a piece of work. The thing about stand up is that you create a show, and then it dies really quickly. Whereas if you write a play, there's a chance that someone might revive that. If you write a piece of music, it's then still performable, even though it was of its time. Someone can pick up that sheet music that's not me and actually go and read that and perform it and do it with an orchestra. So I wanted to create something that felt like stand-up, but then didn't die after one Edinburgh and a tour, which is what we all do. For some reason, our work doesn't have any longevity to it.
Yeah, it is weird. I was already... my interviewer brain is thinking, what's this obsession of Vicky's with longevity? Why does she need a legacy? But at the same time, I'm thinking, I mean, that's literally common sense. Like, why are the rest of us not fussed about the fact that you spend all this work on it, you hone it preview after preview, then you get it ticking over, and by the end of the festival, you're like, it's there, it's finally tooled, it all fits together, and then if you're lucky, you get a tour,
and then that's it.
It's done.
Yeah, I mean, some people might get to record theirs, and obviously that's now a more open playing field that you can sort of organise for your own thing to be recorded and put out there as a special.
What do you think is the percentage of specials that get seen 10 years after they get made that still get seen? I mean, the big...
Not many.
The big...
Yeah,
boys it's and the, girls
it's,
have
well,
those.
Well, I think it's the people that used to release them on DVD, because I don't think many people do anymore.
Yeah.
But if your Sarah Millicans, John Bishops, those people that had DVDs, because I reckon they've had buyouts for more four, because Sarah Millican shows are always on the telly.
Sure.
Minchins are always on the telly, sort of E4 or whatever, and being repeated.
Yeah.
So I think those people that had those deals, they'll still be on, because you'll watch you'll watch an old Lee Evans.
Yes.
But I think the other stuff...
It's like there's, I don't know how many, there's maybe 10 acts floating there.
Yeah.
At the special gets sold as a DVD and then played on telly forever. And then under that, every so often you'll see a DVD in a shop from someone, or you used to, I mean, you occasionally do now, a DVD in a shop from someone who is third tier, for example, and you go, oh, they did a DVD.
Yeah.
But you'll see it in a sort of a bargain bin.
Yeah.
Because you'll go, oh, I wonder how many... I've got no idea of the numbers involved.
Yeah.
Of like how many it takes. Is there something ludicrous, like in the... Back when people used to sell singles for pop music.
It'd
be like, oh, if you can sell 500, you're getting the charts.
Yeah.
Like, there's an impossibly low number.
It's also the same with books, isn't it?
Is it?
Yeah, the physical sales of books. It's not as many as you'd think to make the Sunday Times bestseller list, apparently.
Yeah. Okay. How knowledgeable are you about the business side of it, about those sorts of things? Because you're someone, like I said, it's the body of work you've described, there's no one else has been on the show has got that kind of approach to it, make it last forever, create it, and when you said in instrumentalist, you said I played a load of instruments, it was like 20, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was 20, yeah.
So you're coming at this from somewhere unlike most other people that have ever been on this podcast.
Yeah.
So how much of it is, I suppose I'm developing now as we speak, a pet theory whereby you know how to compose a piece of music, which few people do. You can compose. Do you approach comedy and your career and the rest of it in a compositional kind of a way?
Yes. I don't have the best attention span when it comes to careers. So,
go on.
So I was a really, really good flute player as a kid. So I was in the National Youth Orchestra, National Children's Orchestra, age 12, okay. And was at music school from a very young age.
Doing an unusual thing to a very high standard.
Yeah, so I did my grade 8 when I was about 9 or 10 or something like that. And so, and then
grade,
I went to,
I don't know about music, is grade 8 the top?
The top, yeah.
Okay.
So Jesus. You might do that maybe 15.
Okay.
And so I was... Yeah, I was playing the flute to a really high standard as a child.
Okay.
And I went to music school. So I went to boarding school. I had a scholarship, which is now sadly a scholarship that doesn't exist because mine was a means-tested, government-funded thing, and it's now something that's sadly not there, which I've often tried to fight for because I wouldn't be doing what I was doing without it. That's a side issue. And then I got to music school, and I could have gone on to music college after that, and it wasn't enough. I was like, nah, I'm a bit bored now. So I then went into acting, and I did something called an acting musician course, and I did that for 18 months, and I was bored. And then I went and did musical theatre, and then I got bored of that. And then I ended up doing stand-up. And then a bit bored of that. And now I'm writing musicals.
How long have you been writing musicals?
About 18 months.
So are you about like any minute now?
Any minute now, I'll need something else.
So what is that kind of... But I've done lots of kind of career changes, yeah. Like sort of circus, street performing, acting, and then yeah. I got bored of acting. I thought acting was this thing.
Yeah.
My frustration with acting was you have to sit by the phone.
Yeah. I mean, bored is not the right word. There's also a sort of a bored of waiting. Bored of waiting for the next thing to happen that's not in your control. So that you then look for the next thing that you can control.
Yes. And stand-up, you really can control.
Yes. Oh, my God, yes. I mean, stand-up is fantastic because you can work without an agent and without all the stuff, without castings, there's the grassroots level where you can very, very easily make a living without sort of having someone give you the permission to do it. Does that make sense?
Well, it absolutely does. You can work as an actor if you want. You can throw fringe shows together. You can be in 10 plays at once if you want.
Yeah.
But is it the business aspect of it? Is it that you can't make a living from doing that in the same way as you can with stand-up?
Yeah, you can't make a living. You know, as an actor, someone can't call you up and say, oh, we're missing a Macbeth on Saturday and it's Thursday.
It's 200 quid.
Yeah, it's 200 quid because you nip to Leeds and just, give us your best monologue.
Was it that? I'm trying to get under the skin of what that kind of, what that boredom or frustration was.
Frustration is a better word.
Was it lack of opportunity? Lack of opportunity for big success? Lack of opportunity to pay the rent? What kind of...
Kind of both. So I was 19 and I'd been to the Royal Academy of Music and I'd done musical theatre. And I was starting to audition for things like Madame Thénardier in Les Mis, the funny parts. And that was always the stuff I was pulled towards, was the funny songs in musicals. And I was constantly getting told I was too young for those roles. And I was far too young. You're not having a 19-year-old Madame Thénardier. That's not... I mean, you might have like the third understudy playing it, but you wouldn't get it. So I was being told that I was too young. And so that's when I started writing my own funny songs. So I was like, well, I'll just do my own then.
Okay.
And so I wrote, I'd never thought about stand-up at all. And I went to watch a friend of mine in a terrible play, which wasn't meant to be funny, but it turns out it was a play that was within a play, within a play, within a play, within a play, which is a dreadful way. It's basically, if you can't think of an ending to your play, you turn it into a play within a play. And I was laughing at it because it was dire. And I was sat next to someone called Bill Dare, who's a Radio 4 producer.
Okay.
And we both sort of, we didn't know each other, and we both just went, oh my God, that was dreadful, wasn't it? And he was like, my friend wrote it. And I said, yeah, my friend was in it. And we sort of had that moment at the bar, sort of waiting for them to come out. And I just got chatting, asked him what he did, and he said he was a comedy producer. And I said, oh, I'd really like to get into comedy, you know, theatre and telly and stuff. How do you do it? And he went, go and do stand-up. Most comedians in terms of acting actually come from stand-up.
Mm-hmm.
And so I did a course at the Actors Centre.
Who taught the course?
Rob Hitchmuff.
Okay. I don't know Rob Hitchmuff.
I did a course and I wrote it as a character because you would as an actor.
Yes.
I didn't think for a second I'd do it as myself.
Okay.
So and I did this course and I wrote a character and I did 5 minutes at the end of it.
What was the character?
Dreadful, awful thing. I'm really embarrassed to even say it. I'd not long been in Sweeney Todd. So I decided to have it as a woman who was trying to run a modern day pie shop, but was killing cats to put in.
Great.
That
Great.
Was my act.
Great. That's okay. When you said you were really embarrassed by it, I thought you were going to say, I mean, I won't say out loud what I thought I was, what you were going to say, but there are a couple of route one.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? There's a couple of route one characters for like a, this is my first character, you know, but it's not, that's not that at all.
Well, I don't know. I also had an accordion and I played the theme from Cats on it.
Okay. you know, it's a... It's...
Oh, no.
So you're to what degree of success and to what extent did you feel comfortable in a room full of wannabe stand-ups learning a thing? Did you feel like these some of these might be my people, or did you feel like what did you, how was it?
Well, it was all actors, and pretty much all of us did
because it was the characters. Actor centre,
of course. It was at the actor, and so all pretty much all of us did characters. And in hindsight, I think the person taking the course should have stopped us all from doing that. Because that was all. None of us were able to be ourselves, and so I then sort of found out the hard. You know, I started again, so I'd ended up with this 5 minutes, which I never did again. I only ever did that 5 minutes at the end of that course at that course showcase, and then realised that that was an absolutely terrible idea.
But did it have a value to you in making you go, this is a thing?
Well, it just forces you to write the material and stand up in front of some people and do it. Mm. And then after that, you start in the same way that most of the other people start. You book in a load of open spots and your mates come to the first ones and you get a false sense of that it's going to be fine.
Yeah.
And then and when I started, I didn't actually have any music to do with it. I had no songs. I just did stand up. And someone said to me, if you're doing this, if you've got other skills, use them. Which is weird because actually there's a snobbery about people that use other skills in stand-up.
But there is. I think there's a snobbery about people who play the guitar badly whilst doing their act. Mm. And then I think the better you get as an instrument, is there less snobbery? Like, if you turn up and go, I can play 20 instruments, this is my life, I am music. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? Then does that... Do you think that that's slightly...
I just think musical comedy as a form isn't well thought of as a thing. And it's a tricky thing to put in, like, a club stand-up show. I personally don't think it's a great thing to have at the top of a show. I don't think you want your opener to come on with something that's not stand-up, because I think your audience need to see something that's a bit more what they have in their heads before you can then subvert it.
Okay, yes.
That's in my opinion. It doesn't mean I can't open and I won't. Of course I will, because it's a job. Mm-hmm. But I don't think it necessarily works in a club format when people aren't coming to see you and they're just expecting...
A show, a bill.
And I think that you can have a mixed bill, but you have to present a bit of bill first before you can mix it.
Yes, before you can mix it. Okay, because they're all expecting a person standing in a microphone telling jokes.
Yes, yeah, they are. Yes. It's not to say I'm not capable of it. It's just you have to deal with that sort of, there's a sense of like, this is different.
Yes.
What have we booked?
Yes.
So let's sort of back foot to it.
I suppose that kind of resonates with a similar sort of a snobbery amongst other comics.
Yeah, I think so.
What do you think that's about?
Well, obviously there's the, it's obviously easy for musical people to get applause. And it's much harder to get applause breaks in stand-up.
That would suggest jealousy on the part of people who are getting.
I suppose so, but it just means that you can. There's a thing about songs. If I'm playing difficult gigs full of stags or festivals where they're not particularly listening, it's much easier with songs because you can just then just do them, just do the songs, and you don't notice that people are. You know, they're. You know, you can sort of get away
it
with...
It hurts less if they're not completely focused.
Yeah.
If someone's rolling a joint at a festival, chatting to a mate, and you're playing a song, it's kind of fine.
Yeah, it is kind of fine. So you can get away with a bit more, I think.
Okay.
So in some ways, it can be easier, but in other ways, it can be a lot harder because you've got to work hard. You've got to work harder to make them trust you.
Go on, tell me about that.
I think they have a... I think musical comedy can be quite badly executed in terms of the actual playing. And so people have a frame of reference for it that might not be... or they'll presume what you do they'll presume they know what you do without actually listening to it.
Okay.
So you've got to sort of get them and to get them to trust you quite early doors.
Yes.
You don't have quite as much time.
Yes. Yeah, okay. You don't have as much time.
Yeah.
I don't quite know why they wouldn't trust you. If you like in your show here at Edinburgh, you've got a white baby grand piano, right?
Yeah.
And that makes me trust you. Like, well, even without playing it, you can
understand
absolutely.
And
they
know what they know what they're coming in to see.
Yes.
So there's none of that, which is why I love that. I prefer touring to Edinburgh as well, because it's just great. They've got the same type of audience, and you've got none of the competition. So it's just you having a nice time with the audience. You haven't got to prove anything. I can just get on with it.
Yeah.
Which I love. But maybe I'm making up the other problems in my head. Maybe I'm going on to a club gig with a load of baggage, going, right, I've got to do this. And do you know what I mean?
You don't strike me as someone who has to work hard to prove themselves.
I don't when I'm on at the end. If I'm closing, that none of that nonsense is there, because they immediately presume if you've got that position on a bill,
okay,
that you I'm presenting myself differently.
I think we all have it's like we're all wearing goggles, and there are a unique set of goggles in there, the way through which we see everything, and there might be a preconception that it's interesting. I don't mean to suggest it isn't based on any evidence but that's not something I'd ever considered. I'm not a musical act. That is interesting. So what are there other insecurities, because you seem so bulletproof? And you seem so highly skilled. I mean, Jesus, if you're as good at playing a flute as you can get at the age of 8, or whatever, I mean, I don't understand, like I said, I'm clearly explained, I don't understand the grading system, but if you could jump through all the hoops by the age of 10 or whatever it was, like, to me, that is such an unassailable, like, and not just the flute, like, that's real, genuine skill. I think most comics, and again, maybe this is me projecting my insecurities, sort of secretly deep down, thought, what if it's all made up? What if it's all just that? It's a fucking house of cards, isn't it? What if I just, if the alchemy doesn't work, it doesn't work, and I've got nothing, and I'm standing there naked with nothing. Presumably, you're never standing there naked with nothing, because you demonstrably can do an incredible thing that your audience can't do.
Yeah, I mean, yes, and there is something quite nice about, at least with the music, I choose, and I don't do it as much as I'd like to, but I do choose to have some moments where the music is just nice and you just leave it. You don't have to necessarily put some laughs in it. You can just do something that's just a moment of something that sounds good.
And there's in your Philip Schofield video, there's I remember the song for that, is that like 2012,
something like that.
There's a key change towards the end. Okay.
Every gag has a key change.
Yeah,
at the end.
Like that's incredibly. That is such a sort of. I don't know what. There's probably a word in music for like a sort of a peacock of like. I can do this, by the way. You know what I mean, it sounds great, really.
But that's Victoria Wood's trick. That is a key change. Let's do it every time. That goes up a gear. The ones in the Philip Schofield song are much quicker.
I saw a comment on it saying a lovely tribute to Victoria Wood in there, and I didn't know what they meant. I imagine that Victoria Wood is a thing that people can use to flatter you or to beat you.
Yeah. Obviously, because there aren't many women at the piano doing the thing that I do. My style is not in the same style of Victoria Wood, but there are some musical tricks in there. So the song that she does, Let's Do It, she changes key a longer distance away, but every time you think it's done, it then goes up. It then goes up a tone. So in my Philip Schofield song, I'm not waiting a verse. I do a line and then I go up a tone with another gag, and then I do a line and then I go up a tone with another gag. So it just when you think it's done, it keeps changing key.
So this is Vicky, really enjoying talking to her. I've got to stop saying that. I really enjoy talking to everyone, but she, you know, I really enjoy talking to her. We're going to zip straight back into it. There's no time, almost certainly no post-amble at the end of this either, because I'm up at Edinburgh, the motor is running, the shows are going great, and I'm really managing to write for a couple of hours every morning and take that stuff on stage and turn over new gear. There are some bits which I need to sit and spend a couple of hours
writing just now because they were blurts. You remember the blurts from last week or the week before? I've been doing some cracking blurting and I need to now work out what the funny stuff is about the blurts. So I'm going to get straight back into that. If you are at the festival, you can see Vicky Stone at the Pleasance Courtyard, or you can come and see my new material show, Primer, at the Monkey Barrel, which is at 3 p.m. daily, and it's £5 in advance or pay what you want. All of these and more can be found at edfringe.com. Do you know what? The app, the Ed Fringe app, I think it's called Fringe 2019. Gradually, year by year, they are getting there. I've always found the app very difficult, but I'm using it a lot this year. So if you want to find anything that's going on up here, have a little look at that. If you are in town, remember to get onto the Comedians Comedian Facebook group, because that is where I will be mostly promoting a couple of little special things. We've got Jos Norris this Thursday. We're all going to pile in and see his show at the Hive. I think it's 4:40, but double check. And then at 6:15 p.m. in Monkey Barrel, I think it's venue number 4, but it's one of the Monkey Barrel ones, which are on Blair Street, easy to find. At 6:15, we're all going to pile in and I'm going to interview Jos live about the show that we've just seen. So the more the merrier. Come along to that. You don't need tickets. I don't imagine there'll be enough people to fill that room because it's such a sort of late notice thing. If you would like to be kept abreast of all of those sort of things, the Facebook group is a good place to go, or you can follow me on various social media things at ComComPod. That's all of that. Let's get back to the brilliant Vicky Stone.
Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I want to know more about those kinds of tricks and structural things, because yes, to me they are a closed book and you're going to have to explain. This is an expert leading the blind on this, or the deaf. But this is definitely the sort of podcast where we should be discussing those kind of structural things. And I know there'll be musical comics listening to this. What sorts of other things are that? And I will try and ask perceptive questions about a thing that is just a completely foreign country to me.
Then this is a proper trick. Obviously, as a musical act, I do quite a lot of sort of private gigs or corporate gigs and that kind of stuff. And I have a business.
Obviously to me now. Sure. Yeah, that makes sense. I guess you do.
Well, no, I mean, but because it's quite a safe booking, I think. Yeah. And what I do is that I have a bespoke song that I write for the client.
Okay.
Now, it's pretty much a template.
Of course.
Oh,
you clever bastard.
And all you do really is ask for a list of their, that's what I do, I ask for a list of their sort of, you know, characters in the office, you know, what are their hobbies, give me a fact about them, and I basically have a template song where I rhyme a fact really about the person and they think it's marvellous.
Yeah.
And it's not jokes, it's just rhyming people in the room with the thing, you know, Jeff sports Arsenal and so once crashed his car into the, do you know what I mean? It's just that. And immediately they trust you in an instant.
Yeah.
And then they listen to the rest of your set.
That's great.
Ta-da!
That's great! God, even your ta-das have got, you know, even that ta-da was so musical.
So there's things, there's tricks like that,
sure,
which make musical comedy easier.
Let's stay just on that trick for a minute.
Yeah.
It's a trick. It's clearly a means to an end. Do you feel good about doing it, or do you sort of grimace to yourself and go, oh, I'm going to do that old trick?
Well, I do feel good about it because obviously trial and error takes you to making, you know, finding out how that's how it works, because gigs like that are totally necessary for what we do in terms of, you know, whenever I get booked for a corporate gig like that, I then will sort of use the money to, it buys me time to sit at home and write other things that don't pay in the same way. So you sort of balance the feeling a bit grubby with knowing that it does allow you the freedom to then work on other stuff that probably won't pay the bills.
So
finding a way to do that with things like songs that have templates means that, you know, the people in the room have a better time. They're notoriously hard gigs.
So if I
found a formula that works for them, even though I feel like I don't work hard enough in that scenario, the hard work's somewhere behind me.
Yes.
So I do feel okay about
presumably
doing it.
Presumably you could find a different tranche of details about them and write that into a closer and get a standing ovation and get helicoptered out.
But they might not listen.
Yes,
you do it. You do it at the beginning.
Do it at the very top.
Do it at the very top. Because it's always those rooms.
I'm in both. You get them, do the set, and then you're like, and now it's about Jeff and Arsenal. Boom. And you ascend in some track to me. That's great. Okay, that's a totally great example of a trick. I'm into more, and obviously I know nothing about music, but more like the key changes that, because I think, when I think of Let's Do It, which my knowledge of Victoria Wood is not huge, but I know that song really well. And I remember that it seems to increase the tension, doesn't it?
Yes.
The key change changes the feeling of the song.
Yeah.
So just as you think it's over, it's more urgent.
Yeah.
So what are there in the realm of kind of musical techniques that, like, that's a technique that changes sort of the tension, the jeopardy. Mm-hmm. There's a thing. Okay, this is a favourite thing of mine I spotted about 10 years ago. Suddenly, every new comic seemed to be telling a story where they were quoting a funny thing that someone in the street said or that someone behind a bar said. And they would always preface it. Look, part of the journey to the punchline would be, and then this guy or then my mate said the funniest thing I've ever heard. And then they do the punchline. And it struck me at the time, with my sort of obsessive over-analysis of comedy, that is an artificial increasing of the jeopardy.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
So there's, and then the bloke in the pub said this funny thing.
Yeah.
And then the bloke in the pub said the funniest thing I've ever heard. And it just, everyone goes, oh, here we go, in quite a musical way. There's almost a rhythm kind of jeopardy twist.
Yes.
Are there sorts of things like that? Are there ways in which you can punch gags by doing something simultaneously?
Well, I can also decide in a song whether or not I'm going to let them laugh.
I love it! Tell me all about that.
Well, in the Edinburgh show, I do a song about my nan. The punchline, the first punchline of the song is your nan will tell you, you know, if you look like shit. It's a very simple premise.
Sure.
But in the middle of the song, I could, and I have in previews, rallied right the way through a fast section that's full of jokes, and you don't really let them laugh at the individual ones. You let them catch them, but you don't let them stop and actually make noise because there's no space for it.
Okay.
And so I started slowing down. I let them have one gap. I tried one gap and then two ploughed through.
Yeah.
Yeah. So because if you don't give them space, they want to listen to the next thing.
Yes,
so
they don't, I see.
You can decide not to let them laugh at
all. And the benefit to that, the benefit to you of that is that they store up those laughs. You don't let them out, and then you release them all.
Yeah, or they just sort of get into a place where they're a bit more sort of actively listening and sort of like enjoying it in a sort of...
Oh, yes, you've switched them up.
Yeah.
You've changed them up a gear.
Yeah.
Oh, I love it. So what sorts of things can't you do with music? What sort of things frustrate you? What kind of limitations are placed on you by...
Well, I think that I would like to not... This sounds really strange, but I always think that if I started this stand-up thing but not called it comedy, I might be better off. I think that if I had done music that was funny rather than comedy that was musical, I think I might be in a better place.
Why?
Because I think if I'd have come from music, be like, oh my god, she's really funny. Whereas it's seen as a bit of a sort of, oh, she does, oh, it's not proper stand up. So I would have thought if I'd have just come from not through the clubs, but come from the music side.
Would that have worked? Is it possible? I totally get where you're coming from, because those sidesteps are, you see people benefit from those enormously. I'm brilliant at another thing, and now I'm dipping into comedy from my high level. And people go, and they're funny? Whereas if you start with comedy, of course they're funny. It's like the massive achievement of managing to be funny and learning how to be funny in a true and honest and authentic way. That achievement is completely taken for granted. Because, of course, she's on the bus with all the funny people, so obviously she's funny.
Yeah. So I think if the funny was just like, I'm funny too, rather than...
what would that career path have looked like in reality? Would you have stayed away from comedy? Like, what would you have been doing to pay the bills to... You know what I mean?
Because this is the thing. I don't know. And I think that the paying the bills side of things is because the reason I can make a living is because I'm doing so many different types of things. So, I mean, I write adverts. I've written songs for advertising campaigns and that kind of stuff.
Can you give us an example?
Yeah, I mean, one of my most...
Because you never get credited for those, presumably. Nope. Like, you might write... You might have written tasty, tasty, very, very tasty, and no one would ever know.
Yeah. one of the most successful ones, but it was weirdly also massively hated, is I've written a song for an Irish advert called Head Bombs. And it was meant to be super catchy. It's an advert for Childline that was paid for by Vodafone. And it's obviously on in cinemas and it was on all over Irish telly. But they wanted it to be annoying. And so they had to disable the YouTube comments because it's really hated.
Oh, my God. But you managed to write an annoying song.
Yeah.
So how did you write an annoying song? What was your...
Well, I mean, working with advertising executives made it surprisingly easy.
But did you approach it from the point of view of like, right, it has to have this kind of melody so that it becomes an earworm?
Yeah, yeah, and it's repetitive. So the song goes, ha, 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 that's a head bomb. Like, so it's like, that's the thing. It sounds really, it's got all sorts of trap stuff. So it's all very...
What's trap stuff?
Trap is types of drum beats, electronic drum beats. So it's all very funky and... Not funky is a terrible word. It's all very contemporary sounding in terms of its... You know, you wouldn't know it was me writing it.
Yes.
Because the sounds are really...
So you can write in disguise.
Yeah.
And tell me more about that. I love it.
I don't know. I do, but it's just things like that. So that means that you know, every so often you'll get some money in the background because they'll want to renew it for another, and then something called PRS, which is when your music's on TV or played on, you know, if it's on adverts or if it's used for TV programs and stuff. You just randomly twice a year will just get money through saying, oh, you know, this is all the things that your music's been made on. So one of the reasons why writing things like the concerto is that then that then functions. I want to create a body of work.
Yes.
I want songs that can work for me without me actually having to work.
Oh, God.
Oh, no. But that's it. So my publisher, they have one person that looks after Bugsy Malone. That's their entire job, is licensing Bugsy Malone. Now, the person that wrote Bugsy Malone only fucking wrote Bugsy Malone. So I'm trying to find the thing. I'm trying to write something now.
Yes.
That I can write, other people can perform, and then it just works for you.
Oh,
that and
yes,
so
mate.
So that's
I remember hearing years ago that Stephen Fry wrote My Fair Lady.
Me and my girl.
When he was 18.
Yeah. But that's it.
That's the rest of your life sorted, right? Take risks,
and
experiment, and completely pursue what you want to do, because in the background,
you've got something that's constantly being licensed.
Wow.
Yeah. So it's just...
This is how to get your child to start learning the flute, isn't it? Really, isn't it? Like, you don't get it, man. Well, like, as soon as children understand the value of money, which doesn't happen normally around 8, or whatever it is.
No. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
So there's lots of, like, the front-facing stuff is me doing stand-up and going on tour or maybe being in theatre, but there's a lot of background. There's a lot of background work.
And so is the, like, you've obviously got a work ethic.
Yes.
And is that work, what is that work ethic composed of? Is part of it just that music is fun and you love music? Or is there an element of it which is like, I've got to grit my teeth and get through this? Like, I love doing stand-up. I hate sitting down and writing it. All right, I mean, once it's working, I enjoy sitting and writing it, but yeah. I hate sitting down with a blank page. It's what this whole fucking podcast is about. Yeah. It's me trying to cope with, oh, God, have I given myself homework for the rest of my life? I hate it. and a way to sort of navigate through that and find a way to be comfortable with it. Is there a hard work down the mine element to writing music? Is it frustrating when you can't make it work? I have no idea what it must feel like to write it.
I really, really, really like being extremely busy. And I, last Christmas, I was in a panto in Worthing, and we did 58 shows across, you know, it's 12 shows a week. And during that time, I also wrote one, because I'd got two musicals that are coming out, and both deadlines were coming up for the first draft of them. And during the 58 performances of pantomime, I wrote a new song every 2 days for this show. So they set me up a writing room in the lighting booth. So I took my big widescreen monitors, my keyboards, and I came in every single morning before the show and every single day between the shows. And I wrote one brand new song every 2 days for these musicals whilst doing 58 shows. And there's something about the urgency of that made it happen. And the work is great. If I've got all the time stretching out in front of me, I'm defrosting the freezer.
Yeah.
You know, it's not happening. It's not happening without.
There's an interesting tension or contradiction between your desire to have something set up that's passive income, do you know what I mean? And your enjoyment of working very hard.
Yes.
I wonder if that's how, I don't mean you about this, but I wonder if that's how billionaires get to be billionaires, because they love, I remember hearing, like, people who end up making serious money are people who enjoy making serious money, and that's what they want to do. And a lot of us are just like, actually what I want to do is sit around and have a coffee and watch a comedy show. So that's what I want to do. But if what you want to do is just go on turbo kind of.
Yeah, that was great. I mean, that's the thing I really did love. That time of year I absolutely loved, because I love pantomime. I think there's a lot of snobbery about it again, but I think it's great. I really, really enjoy it. So I'm on stage, I'm doing something fucking ridiculous. It's brilliant fun. So the actual performance job is fun and great. And then the downtime in between the shows is me writing stuff against the clock, because I have to.
And so the performance job is, that's in the bag. You don't need to give it any
thought. I don't have to give it any thought. And I can just, in that particular scenario, pantomime is the exact middle of the Venn diagram between stand-up and theatre, where I'm allowed to break the fourth wall. I can be as ridiculous as I like. I can mess around, and the audience want it and they love it. And it's I feel more free. In fact, that's the environment where I feel most free, is in a pantomime. I feel most at home. And so
I've never heard anyone express that. Pantomime is such a derided form. It's so looked down on.
I know it is. I know it is. And there's nobody really that in a modern sense has really found, I don't think, from comedian's point of view. I do male baddie.
Okay.
So I play a bloke. I play the Abenaza and flesh creep. And it's so much fun, because I've got a particular voice that I do, and I think there's something about playing an insane man that it's just, it's really freeing.
Can you give us a blast of the voice?
Yes, the voice is this. It's Abenaza. That's the character.
Okay.
And it's sort of, it's a bit Alan Partridge.
Yes.
And it's sort of, you play this, you know, Abenaza wants wants to get the lamp. It's so easy to get laughs from playing a male character that just can't see anything else other than the thing that they want. Yeah. And I love it. I absolutely love it.
And you never hear anyone championing panto.
No.
So why is that? Why do you think that is? Why does no one else? Because it's a guilty secret, panto. You know, people get spotted doing, Sanzo's doing panto, and they go,
tax bill. I don't know. I think there's a lot to be had if you're a male comic playing a Buttons character or a wishy-washy. If you're the sort of the comic, you can get a lot of laughs there. I saw Al Murray do it, and he was brilliant. Mm-hmm. And he could basically do his pub landlord act. But in sort of some sort of lederhosen looking stuff. And it's actually really great, and it's really funny. But for women, there's not really the equivalent. I've done a fairy, and it was that I couldn't bear it. It was absolutely awful. There aren't laughs to be had, because what you need, you know, in that role of coming out as a fairy, jumping out of a pyro, you're not meant to be funny. You're just meant to be
carry the plot from A to B.
Yeah, and you're just meant to be magical. And as soon as you put funny into that, you actually take away some of the magic.
Yeah.
But where, as soon as I found this male baddie, this point where I can just be utterly anarchic in the middle of this show, and people love it.
Presumably, the other cast members of this panto, on 12 shows a week. Mm-hmm. Were lying down, fanning themselves the rest of the time. Going, I mean, just, I don't mean fanning with a palm leaf. I mean, like, bloody hell, right, go back again. You know, like, it's knackering.
Yeah.
But you were feeding off it and setting yourself other bigger challenges.
Well, there's you'll find the people that you can play with, and that rhythm becomes quite apparent after a few shows. So you work out what cast members you can improvise with. And then the one last year I was with Lee from Steps. And one of my favourite things was just looking at his face every time I went off the script. He was like, he was just sort of staring at me, like just looking, going, when are you going to say your lines? Like absolute fear and panic. And then I'd have to sort of say his, really, to get us back, to help us get back on track, which is a bit mean of me. So as soon as you realise that you're in that situation where you've got a pop star looking at you going, please say your lines.
Say the cue. Yeah, right.
Please say the cue.
So I want to get back into, not the work ethic, but the motor, the engine. Yeah. So do you ever... Like you said, there is that. So sometimes you want to defrost the freezer. Sometimes you don't want to do the work.
Yeah.
So is giving yourself a big, terrifying deadline or two terrifying deadlines at the same time, is that the only way you can make yourself do it? Is it one of your techniques of getting yourself started? What other things do you do?
Pretty much deadlines is it. Without a deadline, I can't find myself doing it.
I can't imagine you sitting at home. I can't imagine you... twiddling your thumbs.
Oh no, I mean I don't twiddle my thumbs, but I'll get out a book and I'll, like, for instance, I decided that I wanted to play, this is really random, but the Philip Glass piano etudes. So I'll sit down and I'll put a metronome on and I'll learn these Philip Glass pieces, but they're for nothing. So
wasting my time learning some Philip Glass. God, when are you gonna get a real job, Vicky?
But that's the kind of shit that I. So yeah, I'm not a twiddle a thumbser, and I'm also I run a lot as well. So the sitting still, I don't holiday well. Genuinely sitting still and doing nothing is not something I can do.
So why not? What happens? What thoughts do you start thinking if you're sitting still?
What's next, and what do I have to do, and what's urgent, and you know, there's pretty much all, there's never nothing to do, so I'm not very good at letting myself do nothing, even though.
Because the reason I ask is one of the things that really interests me is why people are the way they are, and obviously in your case that sort of drive is enormously beneficial to you, and you do hundreds of fun things. If there is also an element of it whereby you get a bit frustrated sitting still, it's not like there's anything to cure there, because it benefits you enormously.
Yeah.
But I wonder where it comes from, and I wonder where that kind of... Like, I've got a mate who I'm living with here at the festival, Vince, who is the world's most relaxed man. You know? And I'm sure you've got friends like that who are just sort of like, what I'm going to do today... Or another comic friend of ours was talking about their partner and the fact that their partner can just go... I think today I'm just going to relax. And my friend is like, what the fuck do you mean? You know, like, how do you do that? So is there a sort of, I don't know, bluntly, is there like a mental health component to, if I don't keep doing the things, then something will happen?
Yeah, I think so. And there's definitely a sort of wanting to keep the ball in the air and keep doing things. And
because what happens if you stop?
Oh well,
fictionally in your head, what is it that's going to happen?
I suppose it's not, you know, not wanting to be. There's something about what we do is that we turn our thoughts and we presume that our thoughts are probably the same as other people's thoughts, and we turn them into art. I either turn them into songs, or I'll turn them into a musical or a piece of stand up. So almost everything that you're almost clocking everything that you feel and think, and you're going, you're either subconsciously or consciously storing it for later.
I mean, I absolutely agree with that. No one's ever really articulated it like that before, but I absolutely have got one eye on everything I'm thinking, mm-hmm. is that a bit? Is yeah. that a worthwhile observation? Would that resonate?
Yeah.
I've just felt that very strongly. Oh, I'm feeling this again. I wonder if other people are feeling this. Laura Davis, who I don't know if you know Laura Davis, Australian stand-up, right. moved to the UK. Brilliant, brilliant stand-up. She was on the show last year and she was talking about how artists sort of take an idea. She said this is a particular stand-up. You pick up a thought and you hold it up to the light and you go, you too?
Yeah.
You as well? Do you think that? You know. And to me, that was the most elegant description of what the thing is. But absolutely, you're always clocking every single thought.
Yeah.
So does that mean then that the energy to do stuff with it is like, what, that those thoughts will be lost if you don't turn them into a song or a story or a bit? Or is
it
just
know.
That the tap's turned on, it's all coming out of you, might as well monetize. You know, might as well.
Yeah,
might as well.
If I do relax, I find myself having to go to a place where it's like you're paying to go and relax. So like a sort of spa holiday. Do you know what
your
I mean?
Your body is tensed up so comprehensively. Your mouth has gone weird and your throat, you know, I've got to go to a spa holiday.
No. So you're like, hello, I'm at the place of relaxing now.
What's that about?
Well, that's like handing over the responsibility to someone else. So if you're going to a place that's meant to yeah. relax you, it's like, go and sit in a sauna. Yeah, you know, that's what I'll do. I'll
see you sitting in a sauna, desperate to write a thing.
Yeah, but that's what I do. If I'll go to the gym to go and relax. And actually, what I tend to do, actually, what is relaxing, is I run as fast as I can to really loud music. Because yes. then you haven't got anything.
Yes. Yes. Okay. Then you haven't got anything. You haven't got the. What is the anything though? I'm determined to get to the bottom of this. Is it there's some sort of cloud there going?
Yeah.
You've got to keep going. Or,
yeah, yeah,
or
yeah.
What?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think for me, I don't ever feel like I feel like I have to keep going because I've not got there. But I don't even know whether or not when and if I get there, I'll know.
Is there a there?
Exactly.
Aren't you not there now?
I don't know. This is the thing: is I feel like I'm always. Like running, physically running and trying to keep on like the next thing and what's next. And for the first time this year, I'm talking about projects that are happening in 2023. Like we're looking at things that are really far ahead and you sort of go, that's amazing. Does that mean that this is a thing and I don't have to worry?
Is this success now?
Yeah. And I don't know. And I don't think it is. So I feel like I'm keeping on because.
Do you imagine that there is one particular gig or show or award or event or role that would make you go, nah, done it?
Well, I have something that I've got this. I've just at the process of signing off on an album that I've been making, and it's a concept album of a new musical that's going to be animated, and it's been recorded by a 10-piece orchestra and the most amazing people. And I've got it, and it's the. You know, everyone says this cliched phrase, but it's the best thing I've written. But it's a thing, and it's ready. It's not going to come out for a while. I have a feeling that that might be the thing. I think the music's good enough. I think, and it's going to last, and it's not going to disappear. It's not, you know. I think it could be then a show that goes on and on. I think, I hope that's the idea. And so I'm sort of waiting. I'm personally right this second. I'm waiting for that because I think that could be. That could be the one, but I don't know quite what I'm going to do if it's not. Well, I've got another one that's on the go.
So where was this, in what crucible was Vicky Stone formed? Were you put under parental pressure to learn the flute when you were a kid?
Yes. It was very much, if we're paying for the lessons, you have to do the practice. And
did you want them to pay for the lessons? Did you want to learn the instrument?
I think so. Yeah. I liked it. And I did an awful lot of practice. They say 10,000 hours, isn't it? That's what. And I think you basically, if you do that early doors, there's no magic to it. It's just the practice. And I remember I wanted a pair of cherry red Doc Martens. It was the 90s, of course I did. And to get these cherry red Doc Martens, I had to cross off all these things on this board. And it was all things that I had to practice on the flute.
The board piano. Written by your parents?
My mum. It was all in little boxes, and it was to play a certain piece a number of times. And for my grade eight, we had something called the scale pot. And there are 128 scales that you have to learn for your grade eight. And you will only maybe get asked about 30 of them, but you have to know all 128 perfectly. And my mum had three pots. There was pot A, and if she picked a random scale out of the pot and it was perfect, it went into C and it was done. And if it was a bit dodgy, it went into B, and if it was bad, it went into the other one. And we'd go through that pot every day and make every single one of the 128 scales.
Did she perfect. Play a musical instrument?
No. My granddad did. My mum plays a bit. I think it's just work ethic. It was just, yeah, it's just...
Did you resent it ever?
Yes, absolutely. I had no half terms. I had no holidays. I was taken out of school on Fridays to go to London for flute lessons. You know, every half term was a National Children's Orchestra, and weekends were going to the Northamptonshire County Youth Wind Band. And
when other people would have been learning how to relax.
Well, just playing, yeah. Just having mates.
Did you have mates?
Not particularly, no. I had mates from music. I had mates in the orchestras and things like that. But there wasn't, like, you wouldn't go around someone's house and...
Play.
Yeah.
What? Did that ever come up? Like, with your mum? Did you ever row? Did you ever go, I don't want to do it?
Yeah. I became quite badly behaved when I was in my teens before I went to music school. Because if I didn't have to go... I did my GCSE music early and I didn't give a shit about anything else. And so nothing was interesting to me at school. And because I wasn't going on Fridays, because I was going to flute lessons in London, then why? Why does the rest of it matter?
Yeah, so right. Oh, that's interesting. So we'll just take you out of this because your parents are prioritising...
You would be allowed to do that now. You wouldn't be allowed to not take someone out of school. But that was the thing, is that I used to just go on the train from the Midlands to London for my flute lesson.
Because you're from Rugby.
Yeah.
I grew up in Leamington.
My dad's
office was in Rugby.
Yeah.
I have fond memories of Rugby. Playing with a photocopier.
Yeah. And then when I got to music school, it was brilliant. I absolutely had the time of my life because I was looked after.
Yes.
So at music school, at 7 o'clock in the morning every single day, you'd have to do early morning practice. It was part of the scholarship. And I had to do early morning practice before school from 7 to 8. And I'd play long notes for an hour every morning. And then you'd do practice every evening. Playing long notes to work on your tone on the flute.
Okay.
So you just work on breathing and tone. Which is that's really kind of, if I think about it now, that's quite a sort of yoga thing.
It's
isn't
quite
it?
Meditative.
It is
isn't
quite
it?
Meditative. Yes. So you'd do an hour of that working on that, and then in the evenings you'd do 6 to 8. Practice your pieces. Now, I rebelled when I was there, and I got together with a friend of mine, and we were meant to be in separate practice rooms practicing our various instruments, and we'd get together and we wrote songs. We weren't meant to, but obviously no one stopped us because it's music, isn't it?
It's
a positive thing to do, but we thought it was against the rules. It was, but we ended up writing songs together.
So that managed to continue your practice whilst allowing you to sort of embody a rebellious
yes.
streak. Yeah, I understand.
Yeah. And then once I was at that school, there were so many things to nourish, mm-hmm. you know, to be in an environment where I was... And I think if I'd have stayed, I would have, you know, I wouldn't have ended up with decent A-levels or anything like that if I'd have stayed outside of a specialist arts okay. education.
So lots of pressure from your mum.
Yeah.
You haven't mentioned your dad. Was your dad on the scene? Was he?
My dad was on the scene. I mean, my show instrumental was about him. Okay. The reason why I think I am what I am, my dad was an alcoholic and he died in 2013. And I was the eldest child fighting for attention between alcoholic dad and the younger brother. So that's that's the see me.
Sure.
That's the stuff.
And... sorry to hear about the death
that's
of your dad.
Right.
I feel that's just on the cusp of how long. It's not quite ancient history yet, is it?
No,
that's
no,
not that long
well,
ago.
The show instrumental ended up being about that because at the time I couldn't write about anything else.
That must have just happened, of course.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it wasn't. The show didn't set out to be about that, but I just couldn't. I couldn't not. It was so sort of, and it was cathartic getting it out there. But the trouble is, it then became a cliched dead dad show, which is a terrible phrase that we've coined in comedy.
Yeah.
Because if you're writing a show like that, you've been through trauma, so we flippantly throw it around, don't we? If somebody's writing a show about The death of someone. Yeah. That's a sort of derogatory term.
I suppose, and I it has literally just occurred to me, forgive me, this is insensitive given this, but it's only just occurred to me, we don't really have dead mum shows because women live longer. So at the age at which you're at the end of the festival grinding out your career, probably your dad's dead. Oh, God, that's heartbreaking.
Yeah, yeah.
God.
Yeah.
Okay.
And when it happens, I wouldn't have been able to stand at the Edinburgh Festival and not talk about the thing that's happened. You know, this year's show, if anyone's doing light shows, it means that they're probably right.
I saw this year's show. At the top, you go, this is light. Yeah. And then it really is. It's light.
It is light. It is light. It's not misdirection.
Sure.
Like, this is just...
Although, having said that, without wanting to spoil anything, the costumed element towards the end, during that number, I found it really affecting. It's very well written, it's beautifully sung, and even though the subject matter is incredibly light, I was like, you fucker. So that seems like you... my preconception there is that you experienced this horrible life event in 2013, and then only a year later... had composed an excellent, incredible bravura piece of work about it that you also found cathartic.
Yeah.
Because what you are in the world is a person who takes a thing in and very efficiently, and I don't mean anything negative by efficiently, but, you know, you might make a show in a year when it would take people 5 years to process the stuff and make the stuff because you compose.
There's something... Writing it down is a good thing. It's I think for anybody, whether you're professional or not, I think that turning emotions into words and music is a nice thing to do.
I'm deeply jealous of it. I'm tone deaf. I can't sing. My wife constantly laughs at me if I try and sing along with something in a mean way. She's mean. because I try and sing along with something and I'll think I'm singing along with it and I'm just not. And I remember a conversation years ago, we were talking about what superpower would you have? And I said, I'd just like to be able to really sing. You know, like just to... everyone else was saying flight, invisibility and everything. You realise that's an achievable dream, Stu? I went, I'm not sure that it is. but the idea, like those moments, those kind of ecstatic moments of singing along to a thing or that bit when that bit comes in, bah, bah, you know.
Yeah.
And I've two children now, so those bits for me happen during Moana. You know, where I'm like, oh, God, what a piece of music.
Yeah, and I think the reason why I'm now moving into musicals, and I think I wouldn't be doing it without stand-up, because the cliche thing about writing stand-up is that you learn an economy of text that you will not learn anywhere else. You know, the economy of writing, you are made and you are forced to get everything down to its lowest terms. So without having learnt to write songs in stand-up, my lyric writing, I think, would be baggy, and I think I would leave it far long before... I tweak it now within an inch of its life, and I don't think I would have that skills. I don't think I would be there as a songwriter. So the album that's hopefully coming out at the end of the year in October, this musical, has got loads of songs that deliberately aren't funny. They're not meant to be. They're just meant to be songs. And I hope that the observational, the way of looking at the world that I've developed through stand-up means that hopefully these songs now are in a much better place than they would be without it. One of the ones that is most personal is a song. This musical is from the point of view of animals, and it's set in a zoo. But it's called the Zoological Society. Shouldn't really be saying this, but never mind. It's called the Zoological Society, and there's one particular song where I wanted it to be about. It's about anxiety, and it's about the thing that being able to put words to something that you can't describe. So the lyrics are things like. You feel like you're lost, but you know that you're here. You feel afraid, but you don't actually know what you fear. That's one, you know. And so it's about sort of feeling like there's something missing. But all these animals are also singing it from the point of view of they don't know anything other than captivity. So they don't know that their potential, their life, there could be a more freer life for them. Mm-hmm. But they don't know the words for it. But it also works on the level that it's also about anxiety. So I basically took all of my own feelings on anxiety and just examined them to the point where, ta-da! And hopefully, you know, and it's obviously without laughs, deliberately without laughs, and you know, putting something like that into the world for the first time is a bit scary.
And presumably, there is, you said, captivity there, and when I think of the scale pot. I wonder if there is an extent to which it's an expression of feelings of captivity for you.
Yeah.
And with your situation with your father, I don't know, we haven't sort of delved into that relationship with him. I don't know if you got on. I haven't had an alcoholic in a close, you know, close family in my life before, so I don't know what that relationship is like, but is there an element of captivity there?
It's an interesting thing. My dad is really, really, he was a lovely, lovely man, and he would come to watch me all the time. He was insanely proud. So it was very much my mum, my dad's working class, my mum's middle class. My mum was very sort of aspirational and, you know, I want the best for you and your brother. And my dad just went along with it and was just all like, oh my God, I'm so proud of you. You're doing things way beyond I could ever imagine.
But he's not waving the
no.
whatever it is.
Oh God, no, absolutely. No. He'd just sit in the audience and just be really proud. And
that's the carrot and the stick, really.
Yeah, it is. But to the point where when he died, I have to put it on my Facebook or things like that. And people wrote on a post saying, oh, I remember I sat next to your dad in this gig. And it was really tricky because he was always really pissed, obviously, but talking to audience members. So he'd always be like, oh, that's my daughter, that's my daughter. And he'd turn up. I remember I had to apologise really profusely to the people that ran the Crumbling Cookie at Leicester Comedy Festival because I'd arranged him a comp. And I think he rang up to check about that comp every day for a month. So he rang up the venue and I had to have a massive go at him. I was like, you can't do that. And he, I remember turning up at the stage door at De Montfort Hall asking to, you know, I was doing the Leicester, you know, show. And so things like that was just turning up hammered at gigs. And it was tough. It was hard because I'd sort of be sat in the car afterwards shouting at him because it's like, you can't do that. You can't ring up a venue, you know, and I'd get to a gig and go, oh, your dad's been on the phone. It's like, okay, cool.
Mm. I mean, arguably, although frustrating, sort of a benign invasion of your life, a relatively benign invasion of your life.
Yeah, it's harmless, really, in a way.
Not easy though.
No, it wasn't. It wasn't because it was pretty. It was basically anything in the Midlands. Turn up to.
Do you take after him or your mother more? Do you think?
Well, he was a clown. You know, obviously not in any professional sense, but was just really daft, was just really, really silly. And growing up, I did not know that was as a result of drinking. I just thought he was silly.
Sure.
I just thought he was a silly person, but he was just pissed.
Oh.
You know, so the sort of...
I mean, he may have been a silly person as well.
He was.
I know some angry drunks.
He was. Yeah, but he wasn't an angry drunk.
Yeah,
he was just,
sure.
He was just daft and very daft man. It got the better of him. That was, you know, as it does, there's also a thing that catches up with you. If you, you know, he died when he was 59. So yeah, you can't do it. You can't drink to that extent. It will one day just go, nope, that's it. And all the organs went at once.
The self-destructive nature of it. It's like a long, slow suicide attempt.
Yeah, oh, no, no, you know? Absolutely. I mean, there's some really heartbreaking things. My dad took all his pension out because he knew he wasn't going to need it. Oh. He took it all out and he spent it all on online gambling.
Oh, mate.
You know? Yeah, but that's exactly what it was. Just... And at the time, I was, you know, trying to do my thing in stand up, and I drove. He lived in Nuneaton, and I drove from London to Nuneaton to take him to AA on a Wednesday. Mm. You know, to go with him and sort of, you know, at least because him and my mum weren't. They split up when I was about maybe 20, something like that. And she said to me out of nowhere, she'd say to me, "I don't want you to feel guilty when your father dies." And he wasn't dying at this point. She just went, just so you know.
Don't
take this on.
You can't win.
And so there was a real sense of me. That's what, it's not just, obviously I wanted to help him, but I wanted to do everything I could. You know, but driving across the country and taking him to AA. And it was all pointless. The problem with Alcoholics Anonymous is that they mentioned God a lot in it. And that was the out for him. He was like, it's God bothering. Mm. And I tried to explain to him that just change the word, change it to something else, because the techniques do make sense, even whether or not you believe in God. Mm. And he wasn't having any of it. It was just like that was that. So you sort of it was a strange thing, because it's hard to admit, but when he died, there was a relief to it. Mm. that it was over. Because it was inevitable. There was a point where, because every time he went into hospital, he wouldn't remember going there because of what they call the DTs.
Yeah.
When you sort of sober up in hospital, he has no idea. I mean, things like he had to. This is funny saying it out of context, but he had to be in a room on his own in hospital because he went around swinging his catheter, trying to hit people with it. which is funny, but it's.
And did you, in that show, in Instrumental, you feel like you managed to put any of it to bed for you?
Absolutely. Yeah, totally. And I mean, I didn't just write a show. I had counselling and all the rest of it,
sure,
you know.
Sure. Yeah, that's important. If you're listening to this,
it is important,
and you're planning to work through deep stuff like that,
listener. You do need both. I don't think you can just put it on stage. I presented the show in a way... With dramatic tricks. I talked about him as a clown, and I made people, because if I told people he was alcoholic from the beginning of the show, they wouldn't laugh at him.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
so
it wasn't just about him, but I did sort of, you know, the way that I introduced him, and there was lots of pictures, and I talked about silly stories, and you know, and it was all true, because I didn't know he was an alcoholic when I was of the age where he was, you know, trying to sort of like he fell into a canal. I thought it was hilarious as a kid, you know, but actually looking back now as an adult, you're walking with your dad and he falls into a canal.
Yeah.
Like that's not great. So I obviously didn't tell, you know, I told the story in real time. So I you know, talked about, because it was funny.
And you at that time had the experience and the skills and the kind of compositional mind to be able to tell that story.
Yes.
And make those decisions about, like, right, I can't start off with that because that won't be funny. Like, you've got
yes.
the skills.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Because I knew that if you give the audience that you have to hold that information back, because if they have it, they won't be free enough to laugh at it. So. There's an element of you feeling manipulative, because you are actually, because obviously people cried in that show, and you do feel manipulative because you have the skills in order to present the work in that way, to manufacture that happening, even though it's real and it's true. So there's a sort of battle there, because you know you're going to make people cry, but then that's what storytellers. You know, that's what films do. You don't avoid it.
No, of course. You
pace it so that the emotion comes in the right point, so that the rest of it is functioning as a story.
Yeah, that is interesting, isn't it? Like you were saying before about this bit of that song, I don't let them laugh.
Yeah.
I don't let them cry until the right time.
Because if I told them, they wouldn't laugh.
Yeah.
So you've got to allow people. You know, it is a comedy show after all.
Of course.
That was the point.
But
of
that's,
it.
I'm really fascinated by that relationship in a sort of a wider context of you of the artist determining the points at which the audience will feel things.
Yes,
because it isn't random, is it?
Random. No, it is. It is utterly in your control. And in comedy, you learn that. Through previews. I mean, you learn it through previews in plays and stuff, but you don't have the opportunity to do quite as much open heart surgery as we can do in comedy. We can really pick things up and move things around whereas if you've rehearsed a play, it becomes quite problematic to start, you know, if you've got multiple people involved, to start changing things. And so you sort of learn, oh, they don't need that information. And I'm still doing it with my Edinburgh show now. I'm going to make some changes today, because I do realise that I can make something a bit more poignant in the end if I drop a little bit more information in the beginning.
Yes, okay. And what kind of, what sorts of bad habits do you have? What things do you catch yourself doing time and time again? Like I noted, there might be certain joke structures or things I'll spot myself.
Yeah.
I just had a big laugh on a thing in my Edinburgh show yesterday, and then I thought, Yeah, but that looked like a discovery. That's why they laughed, because you looked like you were discovering it and you weren't really discovering. Do you know what I mean? Like, there's sort of certain kind of grooves I fall into. Are there equivalent ones in your songwriting or in your stand-up where you go, this isn't, I've done this before?
Yeah, I mean, quite a nice, easy thing in songs is that you can make things funnier really simply by just underscoring. So there's certain rhythm of musical comedy. You don't just want song clap chat, you'll break it up. And so immediately if I just put a bit of underscore, that sounds quite difficult.
I was just wondering, when I hear the word underscore recently, it was you when some latecomers came in and you underscored them.
I underscored them,
yes.
Yeah, so things like that. It looks like it's in the moment, and but it's, you know, you just can drop into that every time. Or just, you know, if something breaks during a song, I'll be like, thanks for the percussion. Do you know what I mean?
Sure. There's definitely bits.
Yeah.
But are there shapes? Are there kind of, I get them to this point by doing that and I let them down like that, and you discovered it once and now you're aware that it's in the arsenal?
I'm just trying to think of an example.
Like, I have a thing that I claim to have invented.
Okay.
I was talking about it with Steve Dunn, comedy director, last night. I don't know what it, I think it's an unreliable narrator callback.
Okay.
Where you establish a situation and then the callback to it reveals that you were lying the first time.
Ah, okay, yeah.
So, like, that's... I'm sure other people do it, but I invented it for myself. Like,
yes.
A juggling trick or a
yeah.
I was kind of trying to come up with a musical...
Yeah.
A progression? Is that a thing? I don't know. But a thing where you go, oh, if you do that, that happens. And then you see... I mean, with juggling, then you see a picture of a hieroglyph of someone doing it 5,000 years ago. Yeah. Well, I still invented it for me. You know, are there those kinds of...
I'm trying to think of an example.
Like, if there was a component of musical comedy that you could call that's a Vicky Stone thing, is there something that you have?
I don't know. I mean, I suppose I don't know. I can't think of anything. I don't know actually. I don't know. I guess I try and make things as either as beautiful, like the thing at the song at the end of the show, if you took away the comedy and the ridiculous thing that I'm doing, that song could stand in a musical without the comedy, and it would stand alone as a perfectly functioning song.
Absolutely right.
And I try to do that a lot.
Absolutely. I mean, that's the bit, obviously, I was referring to that bit when I was like, oh, that's really got me. And I don't...
But
I,
it doesn't get you because of the text. It doesn't get you because of the... I mean, Nick Helm's mum came to see... they came to see the show at a preview because I think Nick was on afterwards. And he went, oh, do you mind if I bring my mum? And she cried. And it's not a crying bit. It's ridiculous. But it's because...
Yes.
I'm not going to ruin the end of the show, but the thing I do at the end of the show is ridiculous.
Yes.
But the music is so big and swelling and moving.
That people
are moved by it, even though the thing I'm doing isn't even remotely moving.
And there's a delicious thing that happened for me, which is like, oh, God, I'm being moved by this ludicrous fucking thing.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's a Vicky
Stone thing. Yeah, I think that is a thing, is taking the music... Utterly on its own, does that stand up for the purpose that you want it to stand up for?
Yes. And so, we know what's next to a point up to 2023. Plans are in place.
Yeah.
What's next in 10 years? What have you, like, I don't mean a specific project, but like, what's the shape of it all?
Well, I can't quite decide. I'm not convinced that solo stand up is where I want to go. I want to experiment more with the form, and I don't think the comedy environment is the right place for that.
Because?
I think I want to leave it for a bit and then make something away from this scene and then bring it back once the scene has changed a bit and shove myself back in. I don't think I want to come to Edinburgh every year with a new hour and just keep churning it out. I'm bored. It's boring. I'm even though the show I'm doing I like, it's good. I think it's good. It's all right. It's not the best piece of work in the world, but at the same time, it's sort of like I've made it because I'm going to go on tour, and I made it because I'm coming to Edinburgh. But it's not the thing that I'm writing that excites me. I know there aren't any constraints on the form that we create, but I feel like there are, and I think they're probably in my head. So I want to make it somewhere where there is no pressure, and it's not called comedy, and I want to see what give it a rest, and also let these musicals come out, and then see what happens.
We talked at the beginning of this conversation about you going, I'm bored of that. Why do you think that you get bored quickly?
I think I get bored quickly because I think I understand what it is to be a solo musical comic, and I think I've got that. And then I think I need to go elsewhere to find to take that to another place. Now I don't think I can. Maybe it's because I'm physically not actually good enough in the moment of the solo stand-up, but I want to. I don't know how I'd take the things that I've written for musical theatre and put it into the solo hour. So I'm going to go away and do that in that environment, because I think, all these songs that are coming out on this album have been written for 10 musicians, and you know, I'd rather just hand it over to an Arts Council funded venue and let them put it on.
And what about in 30 years and 40 years? What about, you know, what do you want to look back on?
I thought the other day that I quite fancy, because I'm really into theatre at the moment, and I quite fancy writing some shows, and then I quite fancy trying to get into directing, because I've got 3 commissions in the next 3 years to turn out for theatre, various theatres. So once they're out, I'd quite like to see if I can start to, because I'm going to try and assist on a few things this year to learn some directing skills. I quite fancy being an artistic director of somewhere.
Ah, I know. Yeah, you seem the type.
Yeah, I know. It sounds. I never thought my ego would be able to cope with being not on the stage. And actually, I feel so settled handing my work over to other people to let them perform it. I never thought I'd be able to do that. I just thought my performer's ego wouldn't be able to watch somebody else do it, and I'd need to perform it. Turns out I don't, and I actually feel much happier handing it over. So I think there's probably a transition there.
I'm undergoing a similar sort of change myself, where I'm like, I love the work, I love doing the work, I love being on stage, but I no longer love being on stage because it feeds my ego.
Exactly.
Do you know what I mean? I can come off and say, oh, that was great. It was a really fun experience. You know, it's like a dance I did. It was great.
Yeah.
But it's not, it hasn't proved anything to me about my self-worth. Not all the time, but you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But, you know, I'm freeing myself of that.
Yeah. But I never thought I'd be that. I honestly thought that my ego would not be able to, like, I'd feel troubled. You know, that I'd, you know, if I've written these songs, I'd need to sing them. And I've enjoyed so much handing them over to better people. It's been really great.
So what kind of director do you think you would be? Because that's a very different...
Well,
it's a very different skill, isn't it? In the moment, on the stage, able to make the snap decisions, running the whole show.
Yeah, it's interesting. So a musical that I wrote had a workshop of working with Katie Mulgrew, who's absolutely fantastic. I love her to bits. And we're working together on various projects. And we did a workshop of a musical that we've written. We did it in January. And it was directed by a woman called Susie McKenna, who's absolutely fantastic. And I was sort of watching her, and I don't have the correct technical skills at the moment to do with lighting mainly. So that's why you'd have to go around and assist for a bit to learn that sort of thing, because I'm writing a pantomime for 2020. And so I'm hoping, again, that's an environment I'm going to sit in on the whole process.
Yeah.
And again, hopefully try and pick up what I can on the job.
And do you think because I think directing is a lot of personal relationship stuff.
Yep.
It's like gently encourage, some directors gently encourage And some directors, I want tears and I want them now. You know, yeah. that kind of thing. What I mean, sort of thing do you anticipate?
I don't know. I mean, I've never done it. I've never done it. So there's something about... I think there's something about writing. Because obviously some people write and direct their own stuff. So I think probably... Probably it's going to come out of that. I don't know. It's really just an idea of something that I'd like to do next. And ambition wise, I just want to keep doing things that I find interesting and that feel nourishing and not be really poor. Do you know what I mean? Like I don't want to be.
I don't want to be bored or poor.
Well, I spent so much of my 20s living hand to mouth that I don't want to do that anymore. So I don't want to go. I don't want to have to go backwards. Backwards into that territory in order to do interesting things. So that's why it's always going to be a balance of writing adverts and doing corporates to balance the things that then won't that won't pay you in the same way as those things do. But what I don't think the future is, and I think this is again through trial and error, is that I don't think it's doing comedy on TV, and I don't think it's because I've had a go and it's. And I'm not going to keep knocking at that door if they're not answering. That seems a really pointless way.
A bit like waiting on the phone call.
Yeah, and I just think you'll end up being angry. You'll end up being, you know, I don't want to be on the circuit, being cross.
Yeah.
Because it never happened.
Yeah.
You know, I've had a go. I've done some TV. I've done my fair share of TV appearances.
Is there an element by which, in order to, like, as a musician, as a musical comic, there are fewer doors.
Oh, absolutely. Open. Absolutely. And there are things that I don't chase because I know I'd be actively bad at them. You know, I'm not trying to get on panel shows because that's not what my skill set is. Mm. Oh, God, I'd have a go, but I don't think I'd be very good. Mm. And then all you'll get is Twitter vitriol. Like, I'm all good, thanks. But things like when I was doing TV spots, Live at the Apollo wasn't really something that was available to musical comics. It is now, but I'm a bit out of that loop to sort of, you know, not in that. I don't think I'm in the circle of people that are looked at for that sort of thing. I think you can drive yourself mad trying to chase spots like that that are available to few very small amounts of people in our industry. And I think that you go around and you backstage people, and there are a lot of very, very cross people that because they never got that, and it's just the nature of our business that not everyone is, and so many good people won't. So you do need to find the things that will make you feel good, because you can't just constantly, because the circuit generally in this business is a circuit. You'll go round and round and round, getting crosser and crosser. Well, in my opinion, that's what I think, and I do want to avoid that.
Are you happy?
Yeah, not all the time. I am, and this is probably, it's a lonely job. I think that's why I want to move into theatre. I want to work with people, you know, I don't want to be on my own. There's something about, especially Edinburgh, and if you're in a musical or a play, you are sharing the responsibility of, let's say, reviews between maybe 15 people. Maybe there's 5 in the cast, there's 4 in the band, there's 3 producers, there's a director, there's a set designer. If you get a 2 or 3 star review, that is shared between loads of people, and you can shrug it off. But whereas if it's just you and it's just the thing that you've made, I think there's a weird sense of shame in this business about a 3-star review. And you suddenly, if that comes out, you're like, oh fuck, oh fuck, oh fuck, I'm shit. And it's like, it doesn't matter. It's just a thing. It's a tool. If it's for brilliant, stick it on a poster, and that might help some more people to come. But it isn't. I've spent years doing Edinburgh, and I'm not going to read them this year. I genuinely mean that, because I don't want the ego to be pulled in either direction. And you haven't got anyone to share it with, good or bad. So I'm just not going to share it with myself. I'm just not going to. I just don't want to know. I'll just do the thing, accept the people that are in front of me, and get on with it. But I do think in the future I do need to make art with other humans.
Thanks, man. So that was Vicky. Thanks so much to her for coming on the show. A real joy to talk to, and a completely fresh perspective. And, I mean, you know, that whole thing of captivity and getting pushed very hard as a kid,
I don't know how much I subscribe to it. She obviously has a very wonderful and rich experience of music. I don't know if I could put my own kid through a lot of the training. I always think of Jackie Chan in the Beijing Opera School. You know, he went to the sort of opera circus school there. And if you want to be Jackie Chan and have those incredible skills, you sort of have to get a three-year-old and hit him with a stick until he's brilliant. I don't know how much I subscribe to that, but I think Vicky has definitely come out the right end of it and is phenomenally talented. And it's going to be such a pleasure to see what happens with the Zoological Society and all of her upcoming projects. So keep in touch with Vicky by following her online or on... Yeah, just online. don't be actually following her. But you know me, I never have the details in front of me. But basically, it's Vicky Stone, V-I-K-K-I. Google her and you can find out how to stay in touch with her. But I suggest you do. Thank you to Vicky for coming onto the show. Thanks for Jake Crossland for logging. The editor of the show, the producer of the show, is Nathan Wood. Thank you to Rob Smountain for the music. And Peter Dobbing is your podcast consultant. I've been Stu Goldsmith. There will be no post-amble this week. I will try and throw one together next week. Coming up, we have the Cagoules. We have an absolute crackler of an episode with Sarah Barron. And there are plenty more in the diary that I hope to bring to you very soon. Keep an eye out for that Jos Norris one. If you are in Edinburgh and you're listening right now, you're probably not listening right now if you're in Edinburgh because you're busy seeing stuff. But if you're having a little relaxing moment in the bath and taking the weight off your feet, then if you are here on Thursday, Jos Norris at Monkey Barrel at 6:15. Go and get a ticket to see his show first and then come along to that free podcast. Speak to you soon. Bye-bye.
Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.